Welcome to Hot Yoga Radio. It's May the 8th, 2014. Taking my constitutional. It's a very fine day. It's your weather report. A little hazy, warm, springy, and pretty peaceful up here in the hills. Today I want to revisit a topic I've entertained on these podcasts from various angles over the years. And the topic is art, the nature of art, the purpose of art, the nature of artistic creativity, and so on. All the questions that surround a huge question mark itself, art. Before I proceed, I'll say I mean art in the broadest sense. I'm not talking just about painting or sketching or etching or even music, sculpture, architecture, so on. I just mean all of those things, of course, but also human creativity in the round. For instance, I think that philosophy can be done very, very much as art, and in fact needs to be done as art. And it does also need to be done as science and mathematics and logic. Yes, all of those things. But nevertheless, the artistic aspect of philosophy, the creative, imaginative aspect of human beings as a huge and decisive contribution to make to philosophy, to a human questioning of ourselves. But we can also build societies artistically. We can develop constitutions artistically. In other words, we give a role for art in pretty well any human endeavour if we think that the human imagination and the human creative powers are brought to bear on some aspect of our lives. So you can have martial arts. Gardening can be conducted as an art. Love can be an art. Relationship can be an art. And we are indeed great creatures of imagination. The history of human culture and the whole human adventure is a story of art. Now naturally it does, it has its kind of quintessential expressions and manifestations in such things as painting, image making, such things as music, production of organised sound which rouses our emotions, forms them, deepens them, reveals them in many ways. So that's what I mean by art. I'm taking a very big broad brushstroke look at art. And today I'm just going to perhaps introduce a notion which I take from Friedrich Nietzsche. I don't remember exactly where Nietzsche said this aphoristic sentence. And that sentence is, I quote, "Life is only redeemed through art," end quote. So what does he mean? First question to ask, is Nietzsche talking about the redemption of the individual? Or is it talking about the redemption of society as a whole, of a culture, of a whole culture? Or maybe he's talking about something else. I don't think that's the case. I don't know what else it could be about. Or perhaps he's talking about both. And following Socrates, I take it that when we ask the big question, how is life to be lived, that Socratic question, which Nietzsche is not averse to asking on pretty well every page of his writing, it's a question with individual and collective, or social, you might say, or cultural, you might say, aspects, and that the two cannot be divorced. human beings living in society. Even the hermit, which is the extreme case of the individual, is nevertheless embedded in society. He will use a language. The people from the village will bring a bowl of rice and leave it outside the cave. It's virtually impossible to do the complete hermit thing without some support from a community or a society. Of course, the hermit perhaps is the extreme case of the romantic individualistic artist, the artist in his garret. The poet, 9 bean rows will I plant there, and a hive for the honey bee. The poet who retreats to the lake isle of Innisfree, William Butler Yeats. We can't separate the social and the individual. So I propose always, whenever we talk about these kind of questions, being very, very alert to that mutual dependence of those two ways of seeing things, the individual and the collective, or social or cultural, whichever way you want to emphasise the question. And Nietzsche, I think, he's very, very, very concerned for the individual, but it's not as though he's not concerned for society either, though it's a bit less explicit in many, many cases. For Nietzsche, one of the meanings is clearly to do with the fact of his own personal suffering. He didn't enjoy very good health. I think his physical existence was very painful to him very often. And that's why his academic career was relatively short. And he was also somebody, I would say, alert to the possibilities for suffering in human life. Possibly no stranger to some kind of existential dread, which might well be why he emphasised so much the desideratum of the affirmation of life in despite of its tragic character. Somehow we have to say yes to life, even though it's tragic. We suffer, we lose everything we hold dear, we die. And it's a passage between two voids. And you look at it like that, it's not a pretty picture, and you could fall down and gnash your teeth and fall into despair and despondency and depression. So many humans do. Once they have a little bit of consciousness of the nature of the situation, the horror of the situation. Yet somehow Nietzsche wants to say that we have to affirm it. Nevertheless, we have to say yes to it. And that perhaps is, you might say, our yoga tantra task, our meditative task. Inasmuch as there is one, even though ultimately there isn't one, it is just for itself. But nevertheless, we approach everything as a task in some kind of initial way. And in that sense, the purpose of the task is to arrive at affirmation. And that certainly is something that our kind of 20th century, 21st century Western ersatz spiritual culture and its derivations from venerable traditions, both in the West and the East, kind of doesn't very often emphasise. But it's in Tantra particular that you find the parallel notion, the best of it, even though the worst of it can be quite ascetic. Because asceticism is a sense that life is hopeless and we have to overcome it. We've got to develop the strength to overpower it. And of course that is doomed to failure ultimately because of the impermanent nature of the body, the physiology which bears the consciousness in some way that allows the whole game to take place. It will die, it will rot, it will fall ill. The worms will eat you up. So in some sense, that the ascetic desideratum of overpowering, of siddha, is a futile one. Though you might gain something in the short term. But really, really, over and beyond that is affirmation, saying yes to it, in despite of everything. To love it despite the tragic and painful character of it. And it's in that respect, on the individual level, that art's got a role to play. It's because in the act of creativity, in the self-forgetting of the artist, and yet the self-actualisation of the artist through his self-forgetting, the will to power of the artist in the mastery over a medium, over perhaps language if you're writing a poem, stone if you're sculpting a figure, paint and space and two-dimensional space if you're painting a picture, and so on and so on and so on. There's an overcoming, there's a will to power which gets developed and honed up in order to master a material and the skills associated with the wielding, with the manipulation of that material and the resultant expression. Of course, the other medium in this is the psyche itself. Strange as it might seem, an artist does actually have to have quite a disciplined psyche to kind of make any headway in the game. And there's a will to power in that. But this isn't the will to power of the ascetic. It's rather a Dionysian will to power, or even an Apollonian will to power. But nevertheless, it involves a certain letting be, or letting go, perhaps, of the conventional ego formations in order to marshal the energies, which are several, it seems to me, and various, it seems to me also. But to marshal those energies in the creative act. And in that way, life is redeemed. You can be having a terrible time, but you produce your work and you go, oh, yeah, it's worth it. It is worth it. There is the affirmation. Maybe it's just dopamine, but I kind of think it's rather more than that. Now, I just mentioned that there are various energies, and I've talked about this elsewhere. I'm going to look through my podcasts just to see if I've actually done a podcast on at least two of those energies, which, again, Nietzsche identified, the Apollonian, which is a kind of will to form, and he relates it to dream, but also the Dionysian, which is to do with intoxication and orgy and the dissolution of ego very often. Now, these are concepts which in Nietzsche's work have got a history, and they develop and they change. And the relationship between those two energies is conceived of in various ways as Nietzsche revisited and revisited that theme over his creative lifespan. And I have documented that quite carefully elsewhere, and I might see if I can dig it out and give you the dope in the podcast. But for now, let's just take it that there are various energies involved, and it'll depend on what it is that you want to do, what the creativity is aiming at, if anything, what the material is, how it relates to what's going on in the arts and in culture in general and in the world in general at the time that the work is being produced, and so on and so on and so on. Context is important. But also the individuality of the artist, also important. And it seems to me again that there will be, as well as quite a large array of energies, that these will also have individual expressions. It's a bit like everybody's got eyes, but no two people have identical eyes. Everybody has a face, but no two people have an identical face. It's rather like that our Apollonianism and our Dionysianism and all the various other aspects of our lives. It can be quite individualised. Now, any artist, as I just said, is embedded in a society which will have a culture. And though there's an imperative in, certainly, art conceived of romantically as the work of a heroic individual, there might be an attempt in our conceptualisation to minimise that social aspect, but as I've tried to illustrate, there is no escape. And it might be that Wittgenstein's private language argument is quite useful there. I mean, Wittgenstein points out by a very subtle argument that a private language is impossible. Language is only anchored through its social aspect. That's what brings it, in a sense, into reality, which it needs, at least as one of its main functions, to depict. So how does this work? How is life redeemed socially through art? And I think at this current juncture, where I believe that business as usual is not an option, culturally, politically, ecologically, economically, individually, psychologically, it's just not an option. It's just not an option. It's a very fast track towards annihilation of our species. And it might be, that would be a pity in my estimation. That would be a pity, especially as I do find that it is possible to say yes in the face of the tragedy, and I've seen quite a fair bit of it. Probably not as much as some people in this horrible modern world. I've seen enough. But yet life is still redeemed. Life is redeemed. I still want to say yes to it. And for that reason, I would say to it, it would be a pity that no one else had this chance that I've had. It would be a shame and a pity. So how can art redeem life? Because if art's going to redeem life, it in a sense has to show us or power us in the direction away from business as usual. Can art do this? Can we have a revolutionary art? Now we know that a lot of very socially conscious art can be really, really thin and naff. the art that the Nazis liked, they had very, very Philistine tastes. Artists who were exploring the depths of the human soul at the time of the arrival of the Nazis were amongst the first people to be shipped off to the camps and annihilated. They either had to escape or go into hiding, or they were killed. Their art was displayed by the Nazis under the rubric degenerate art, as the greatest artists. Nobody who painted those completely naff portraits of Hitler is remembered. I suppose the only people we remember is people like Leni Riefenstahl, who did have a bit of flair despite being somewhat of a Nazi and was quite willing to work for the Nazi propaganda machine. Similarly with so-called socialist realism. I mean, these could be feats of technique, but somehow empty. I mean, art does need the tragedy of life to give it any kind of juice. And if life is going to be redeemed through art, the art that redeems life has to have a very, very close look at the tragedy of life, at the dark side of life. And I would say that even if we manage to produce a really wonderful utopia, great healthcare, great education, general prosperity, much joy, much celebration in life, if we were to produce that, artists would still have to explore mortality, tragedy, the impermanence of the body, the crazy and probably hilarious drama of our egos. All of this would actually jump into sharp relief if we could produce a social utopia. Certainly our artists would need to look deeply into it. In fact, then they would have the chance to really penetrate it. But at the moment, it's difficult. Artists in practice experience repression, suppression, isolation, madness, poverty. It's not an easy path in the modern world. I'm just on a very quotidian level, as our society here in Britain is fragmenting. City councils are going bankrupt under the neoliberal idiocy. And the first thing that they do is cut any spending on the arts. Now, in this country, we have a great tradition of the Municipal Art Gallery, founded by philanthropists, Victorian philanthropists in many, many instances, but nevertheless taken over by municipalities. And I think this is a phenomenon in the Western world. We have very, very, very great edifying displays of art in pretty well any town of any size at all. But all that's coming under very, very great stress. And recently, a number of councils, Birmingham, I'm thinking of, just had to just cut all of its art spending. Now, I can remember a more civilised time, maybe, even though life was hard. But when I was a lad, every week there was a free concert in the art gallery. At lunchtime, you'd go in, watch a really great classical guitarist or a harp player or somebody come and play a sarod or a sitar or a harpsichord or sing some great song, some Debussy or something. I don't know. It was just there, and people availed themselves of it. It's been dismantled in many places. In many cases, it has been dismantled. So, I suppose the TLDR that I'm trying to get at in this podcast is that the revolution that I keep talking about, it does definitely not want to be a bloodbath. We definitely do not want to destroy any infrastructure. We need it. We desperately need it. Especially the tech infrastructure is going to come in use. At the moment, it's the servant of the biggest companies on the planet, the biggest corporations on the planet, who are standing in the way of any sort of saving of our species, even in many respects, despite what they think about making the world a better place. So what is it to be? And I would just say, just the TLDR, you know, a carnivalesque revolution of love. Now, there'll be a lot of practical stuff to do. And there'll probably be some sticky moments when we have to say to the people in Whitehall, fuck off and retire. You know, you've had your go, now fuck off. Because you're just fucking killing everything. Similarly, with the people who've got massive vested interest in big oil, big weapons, big money. They will have to be deposed, there's no doubt about it. But on the way, we need to build. If we don't build on the way, we'll be left sitting on a pile of dry bones. And the building is art. And it's through art that we build. And it's the building itself is art. That's what needs to happen. Obviously, there's a lot of nitty-gritty, as I said. A lot of politics. But even there, a revolution of love can be operating. And I would say, if it doesn't, we're fucked. It's the only way through. It is the only way through. Okay, so that was a bit of a ramble, but I think I will be revisiting this theme, seeing how different it is this time round the spiral. And so I'd say let's take this as a bit of an introduction to some future explorations of this theme. Over and out. Lots of love. Make knowledge great again.